There we go, there we go.
All right. Yeah.
I'm so proud to be here on Texas Independence Day. Thank you. I'm proud to be here with all of you in this fight. Thank you. Tracing me and you too.
You're listening to KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado. Community supported radio, and we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. If you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of TruthQuest, they are now available at www.givemesometruth.info, INFO, or link to khen.org website. And I'm Melody, and my co-host this evening is Katie O'Brien, and the program is Truth Quest. The opening song was by Jimmy Vaughn, and it was I forgot. It'll come to me in a minute. And I want to say congratulations to Claire tonight for her debut program, and I'm sure she did a great job. And she was filling in for Emily tonight on Chick's Voices. KHEN and Truth Quest is supported by by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Properties Incorporated. Little River Ranch offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at ColoradoHomeProperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. And before we get started, I'll read the disclaimer. The views expressed on this program are those of myself and my guest and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHIN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And Katie and I are really looking forward to this interview this evening with our special guest is John Lear.
So,
are you guys there?
I'm here.
And John?
I'm here.
Okay, great. And I'm going to introduce Don here a little bit. He's 65, retired airline captain and former CIA contract pilot with over 19,000 hours of flight time and over 11,000 in command of 3 or 4 engine jet transports and has flown over 100 different types of aircraft in 60 different countries around the world. He retired in 2001 after 40 years of flying. He's son of Learjet inventor Bill Lear. John holds more FAA airman certificates than any other FAA certificated airman. These include the airline transport pilot certificate with 23 type ratings, flight instructor, flight engineer, flight navigator, ground instructor, aircraft dispatcher, control tower operator, and parachute rigger. John flew secret missions for the CIA in Southeast Asia, Eastern Europe, and the Middle East, and Africa between 1967 and 1983. During the last 17 years of his career, John worked to several passenger and cargo airlines as captain, check airman, and instructor. He was certificated by the FAA as a North Atlantic MNPS check airman. He has extensive experience as command pilot instructor in the Boeing 707 Douglas DC-8 and Lockheed L-1011. John checked out as captain on a Boeing 707 in 1973 and captain on the Lockheed L-1011 in 1985. John held 17 world records, including speed around the world in a Learjet Model 24 set in 1966, and was presented the PATCO, PATCO, Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association Award for Outstanding Airmanship in 1968. He is a senior vice commander of the China Post 1, the American Legion's Post for Soldiers of Fortune, a 24-year member of the Special Operations Association, and member of Pilots for 911truth.org, and John has four daughters, three grandchildren, and lives with his wife of 37 years, a Las Vegas businesswoman, Marilee Lear, in Las Vegas, Nevada. That, you've done a little bit in your lifetime there, John.
That's the short version.
And Katie?
Yes.
Okay. John, would you like to maybe start out and tell us how you got into? I'm actually kind of intrigued a little bit on your early career in what you did in Special Forces. Would you like to talk about that a little?
Yeah. No. What'd she say? I can't hear.
She asked that she'd like you to talk a little bit about what you did in Special Forces.
Okay. It wasn't Special Forces. It was CIA. And 17 years, I flew contract missions. When I first started working for them, I didn't even know I was working for them. I got a job in Wichita, Kansas, flying the forward air control made by Cessna Aircraft called the O-2A and the O-2B over to Vietnam. And the reason they had to be ferried there is because the war was pretty well cranked up about 1965, 1966, and they needed 400 of these airplanes. And they couldn't put them on, there was nothing to ship them on, and they didn't want to take them apart, and they didn't have enough Air Force pilots to even do what they had to do, so they had to put together a civilian group to hire civilian pilots to ferry the airplanes over there. And the CIA was tasked to do this because there was no one else to do it. And so the operation they CIA formed was called World Aviation Services. And they ran these airplanes, and I had heard about this operation. I thought, you know, that'd be pretty neat. I'd like to do that. Turns out I had a couple of friends working there, and they said, yeah, come on over. And I got checked out in the airplane, and I started flying. I think that was in 1967. And I flew for 4 years. I took 10 airplanes over. And so then after that, 1970, I flew for Clay Lacy Aviation in Van Nuys. And then in 1972, somebody said, hey, anybody want to fly a Convair in Cambodia? And I thought, no, that might be fun. So I said, yeah. So I called this number, and they said, yeah, when can you leave? And I said, tomorrow. And they said, great, here's your ticket. And so I had just been married a couple months, and took my wife over to Cambodia, and we lived there for about a year in Phnom Penh. I flew a Convair 440, which is a 52-passenger transport, and it was just for a local airline there. And then when I was there, the guy I was working with said, you know, you can make a lot more money up in Laos flying for the CIA. And I said, well, how do I do that? And they said, well, you just go downtown Phnom Penh to Swiss Indo Shipping and Trading and see a guy named Kurt Fuhrer, and he'll give you an application. So I went down, got the application, filled it out, and a couple of weeks later, somebody came and interviewed me and said, you know, you're hired. You can come up there. So I went up to Laos and started flying C-46s and Twin Otters for the CIA on their missions they had there. Now, they had two airlines there. Number one was Air America, and the people I worked for was Continental Air Services, Inc. And we did the same job. They just had a lot of work to do, and so they needed two airlines. So basically what we were doing is supporting General Vang Pao, and who was trying to stop the Pathet Lao, and he was trying to interdict the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which came from North Vietnam down through Laos and Cambodia into South Vietnam. And so I was there for about a year. I flew 560 combat missions, and it was very interesting. I got shot down once. Actually, I got shot up because I made it into a friendly strip. But it was interesting. And then came back after the war, and in 1977, I got a call to from a guy who said, we need a 707 captain to fly some flights over in the Middle East. And I said, okay. He said, are you available? I said, yeah. And he said, well, I need you to be in Frankfurt tomorrow. And so I said, okay, can you wire me a ticket? He says, no, I can't do that, but I'll pay as soon as you get off the airplane. So I said, well, I don't like doing this, but I'll do it. So I went to Frankfurt and checked into the Intercontinental there at the airport. No, it was Frankfurt Sheraton, I think. And got a call, and the guy said, tomorrow morning you're going to take Lufthansa flight so-and-so to Budapest, and you'll go through customs there, and there'll be a guy to take you through customs, because, you know, that was back in 77, and Americans weren't allowed to travel in those Eastern European communist countries. So I went down the next day and got on the airline, and I happened to run to a bunch of my friends who I'd been flying, you know, other programs with, and they were in on this deal too. So we got to Budapest, and our instructions were, after we cleared customs, to go to the Intercontinental Hotel. And so we all got in a cab and went over there. I think there was about 12 of us. So we went up to this room, and we went to our rooms, and about an hour later, we all got a call, and it said, go to room so-and-so. So we all end up in this room in Budapest. It was late in the evening at the Intercontinental Hotel there. And this guy meets us, and he introduces himself, and he starts talking about the history of Budapest. And then as he's doing this, he has a piece of paper, and it has some instructions on it. It was a whole page of instructions. And he hands, as he's giving the travelogue and the history of Budapest, he hands it to one of the pilots and points at him, like, read this. And so what he was doing is briefing us on the mission, but if anybody was listening, all he was doing was giving us a travelogue. So after he gives us, after each guy read the instructions and gave him the thumbs up, I understand, you know, what I'm reading. And the instructions were stuff like, don't trade money on the black market. If anybody asks you what you're doing, don't talk to anybody. Don't talk to any reporters. If anybody asks you where you're going, you know, don't ask them. If you're forced to tell a place, then say you're going to Nigeria. Things like that. And then at the bottom of this piece of paper it said, remember, walls listen. And it was underlined. So then when the last guy is done, he said, now we're going to go out to the famous chain bridge that crosses the Danube. And it's a very pleasant experience. And we'll have dinner afterwards. So we went to, there's like I said, there's 12 of us. We walked downstairs and took the elevator down, walked out of the hotel, walked across a few streets, and there's a beautiful lit chain bridge. And I forget what the name of it is, but it's one of the most spectacular sights in Budapest. And we walk out into the middle of this thing, and there's no one for miles. And he gives us the briefing. He tells us what we're really doing and where we're really going. And that was in order to keep it secret. And he said, we're flying arms and ammunition out of Budapest to Somalia, Mogadishu. And this is in 1977.
So and we've been there a long time.
That, what was going on is Russia had traditionally supported Somalia against their enemy, Ethiopia. And the United States had traditionally supported Haile Selassie, the emperor of Ethiopia. Well, what happened is, and also Russia had built a deep water port on the Red Sea side of Somalia. So what happened is the Eritrean rebels started to upset the Ethiopian government, and Russia went up there and started to help them. Well, this irritated Somali. They said, look, you're helping our lifelong enemies here. You can get out of our country. So they kicked the Russians out. And we came in and said, hey, we'd sure like to help you out here, because the reason we wanted to be in there is the name of the game in the Red Sea is real estate on the Red Sea, because if they ever closed the Straits of Hormuz up there in the Persian Gulf, all oil has to come out the Red Sea. And they built this great, big, huge pipeline that comes from the oil fields across Saudi Arabia to a little town called Yanbu. And all the tankers will go up there, load up, and go out the Red Sea. But if you don't have real estate on the Red Sea, like if you don't have a port or anything, you're in, you know, at the mercy of the other guys. So we wanted that deep water port. So what happened is we go in there, they have started helping the Somali government, and now they get ready to fight their traditional wars. The problem was all of the guns and all the guns they had were East Bloc ammunition. They needed East Bloc ammunition. And all the guns that the Ethiopians had were West Bloc ammunition. So a top-level trade was made at the very, very top of the governments to trade the East Bloc ammunition in Budapest for some of the ammunition we had left over from Vietnam. And I was in on taking that Budapest ammunition down to Somalia. So
we've been there.
Are pretty interesting. It's the country named Aden down there in South Yemen wasn't too happy about this, and they were trying to force the airplanes down. But we had our airplanes painted up like Somali Airlines, so they forced one down, but it wasn't a cargo airplane; it was a passenger airplane. So they didn't try that again.
So it sounds like it's kind of just as dangerous to be flying for the CIA, or more so than it is if you were in the service as a pilot.
I'm not sure I understand you, but I can hardly hear you. But
okay,
I didn't fly for the service. No, it was strictly CIA contract flight.
Right, right. No, I realize that. But what I'm saying is that it sounds like it's pretty dangerous working for the CIA too.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you get paid for, you know, and they make it clear that if you get caught, don't call us, because we're not going to know you. We won't know you, you know. If you get caught doing this, you have to go to jail. You know, that's too bad. That's, you know, that's what this job is about. they're certainly not going to go and, you know, get the State Department to save you or anything. They're going to deny everything. That's what they did with Hassenfuss down there in the Costa Rica or wherever it was here a few years ago in the incident down there where the guy got shot down.
So when did you quit working flying for the CIA?
1983. In 1981, I went over there because in 1978, Israel and Egypt signed the Camp David Accords that Jimmy Carter put together. And one of the provisions of the Camp David Accords was that each country, Israel and Egypt, would fly into the, would make a daily airline flight into the other country four times a week. So El Al is the national airline of Israel, and they didn't mind flying into Egypt, but you could not find an Egyptian that would fly into Israel. So the CIA formed an airline, secret airline. It was called, what was that thing? Oh, Air Sinai. And we pretended we were Egyptians making three, four flights a week. And so we do those four flights, and then we do subcontract for Egypt Air, which was the national airline for Egypt, because, you know, going to Tel Aviv in the morning, it's only an hour over, an hour back, and we only did that four times a week, so we flew a lot of extra flights for Egypt Air. And then the original reason I was sent over there was, we all know about the October surprise in the 1980 in October when Ronald Reagan was running with George Bush against Mondale and let's see, I guess it was Carter and Mondale, right? And so we had the, you know, the Iranians had held the embassy personnel hostage there, and Carter was trying to get him back, he couldn't do it. And of course Reagan says, well, when I get to be president, I'll, you know, be able to work it. So what happened behind the scenes is George Bush was flown over to France in an SR-71, the Mach 3 high-speed airplane, and he had a secret meeting with representatives of the Ayatollah Khomeini. And his deal was, if you delay the release of the hostages until Reagan is elected and until his inauguration day, we will supply you unlimited guns and ammunition throughout our administration. And the Ayatollah accepted that agreement, and of course held the hostages. Reagan got elected, and the hostages were released on the day that he was inaugurated, as promised. So then the all the arms and ammunition that we promised had to start flowing into Tehran. So Mossad, who was running the operation for the CIA in the Middle East, was getting all the stuff, all the weapons and ammunition in Tel Aviv, and I was supposed to fly it from Tel Aviv to Tehran. So the route from Tel Aviv to Tehran is first you go north to Turkey, and then you turn right and go down that corridor. It's about a 100-mile corridor between Russia on the left and Syria and Iraq on the right. And, you know, it's plenty of room, 50 miles on each side. It's no problem. And then zoom into Tehran, drop the stuff, and come out. And Turkey's promise for letting us fly over their airspace was that we had to drop every other load of guns and ammunition in Turkey. So anyway, as this thing is getting underway, the Mossad wanted to test, you know, make one test run before they sent me in 707s on this, you know, what was going to be a fairly dangerous run. So they sent in an Argentinian SEAL 44, which is a huge old turboprop, and it can carry lots of stuff. And so they made the first run in. They loaded up in Tel Aviv and flew up and down the corridor and landed in Tehran, unloaded everything, and started their way out. And as they got to this little pinch point where you're right between Russia and the Syrian and Iraqi border, some MiGs came down and intercepted them. And the first thing that anybody in the news knew, the CL-44 had been shot down and all four crew members were killed, and it was shot down in Russia. Well, nobody could figure out what happened because everybody knew the route. Everybody knew there was, you know, there was 50 miles on each side and not to violate, you know, any territory. And so the only thing they could come up with is they figured out that the Russians must have come down and intercepted them. And they thought that what the CL-44 pilots probably thought was, look, we haven't got anything on board. They can't prove anything. We'll just follow them. So the Russians, as soon as they got them over Russian territory, just shot them down. And so that put an end to the 707s going because they couldn't risk that happening. So that project was canceled. And I think they eventually sent those arms to Tehran out of one of the Persian Gulf countries like Qatar or Dubai or UAE, one of those countries. But anyway, when I finished up, I did a couple more missions. We had a run out of Greece down to South Africa, and there was one during the Falklands War. It was planned, but it never went off. It was so miserable living in Cairo. My kids were like 4 and 5. You know, couldn't get any Western food, and Marilee, my wife, was pretty much fed up with this, so I said, when I get back, I'll quit all this nonsense and go to work for, you know, just a regular airline, which I did. We came back in 1983, and I went to work for American Transair, which is a charter company, and flew with them till 1989, and then went and flew cargo until I retired in 2000.
Well, it sounds like you had a pretty exciting career there in the Middle East, too.
It's been interesting.
Uh-huh. So, ultimately, we were supplying weapons then to Iran and Iraq then during that period. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, on the information you sent me over, you made a statement that no airplanes of any kind hit the World Trade Center or crashed on 9/11. You want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, that's correct. The 9/11 truth movement has two factions. One faction is plane huggers, and the other is no planers. Now, plane huggers think there were real airplanes, that whether or not, you know, they don't necessarily say actual Arab hijackers flew them, but they say that actual planes crashed at the Pentagon, at Shanksville, and the World Trade Center. I'm a no planer. I don't believe, well, it's not that I don't believe, I know no planes crashed at the Pentagon or Shanksville or the World Trade Center. It was computer graphics done, it was very cleverly done, it was essentially magic, but no planes crashed. So the problem with trying to get people to understand this is what I call technology ignorance. Unless you know the technology that they used, you're going to believe what you see on TV. And if you see airplanes crashing into the World Trade Center and great big balls of fire and hear people screaming and ambulances doing that like that, and you don't know how it was done, you're going to believe airplanes really flew into there. But it was all magic. It was, you know, that didn't happen. Those buildings certainly exploded, but it wasn't because airplanes flew into there. And then when they collapsed about 45 minutes later, what people don't understand is if it was controlled demolition, when somebody, a professional company, comes in and controlled demos a building, they have to deal with the collapse of the material, the steel and the concrete, which usually ends up about 13%. In other words, if you had a 100-story building, the rubble would be 13 stories high. Both the World Trade Centers were 110 floors, or 110 levels. So there should have been a debris about the height of 11 stories, and there wasn't. There was no. The debris didn't even reach one story. There was nothing there. We're missing 500,000 tons of concrete and steel. So I'm a no planer. Now, I'm not sure what weapon they used to destroy the World Trade Center, but I'm fairly sure, based on what I know, that it was a weapon that's been placed in orbit And it's some kind of a direct energy weapon. How it works, I don't know. Some say antimatter. I really don't know. But I believe it was fired from space, and it went straight down, and that's what got the World Trade Center, and that's why there's nothing left. That's why there's 500,000 tons of missing concrete and steel. And that's why there was only dust remaining there. It was like a foot thick in places, and it was just this weapon that we reduced it to nothing.
And that very much explains why Building 7 just collapsed and it wasn't hit by anything visible or shown on TV.
Okay, the reason Building 7 collapsed, and that was absolutely controlled demolition, well, controlled demolition or the direct energy weapon, what happened is there was supposed to be a Flight 93. They were going to, you know, use computer graphics or maybe holographs or something, whatever, to crash into, you know, to pretend to crash into Building 7. But for some reason, they couldn't do it. Something happened that they could not make that simulation. And so they had to wait till 5 o'clock in the afternoon and just go ahead and do it and hope that the public would just, you know, oh, yeah, sure, you know, it just collapsed like that.
Well, you know,
but now you ask, why did they do this? Why did the secret government or whoever did this, why did they make this scenario that Arab hijackers got airplanes and they hate our values and hate our country and decided to fly in the World Trade Center? Well, what they want to do is come up with a reason to go into Afghanistan. And Afghanistan in 2001 only had 14% of the world's output of opium growing there up in the Hindu Kush. And the Taliban was burning down the poppy fields because it was against their religion. And banking was coming to a stop because 80% of the world's banking runs on the movement of illegal drugs. So we had to have an excuse to go into Afghanistan and go up to the Hindu Kush and start cultivating, planting, harvesting, and distributing drugs worldwide. That's where the money for black projects comes from. So apparently we were very successful because the New York Times reported in August of 2007 that now Afghanistan was responsible for the production of 94%. Of the world's illegal drugs.
There's a long history of that. Anthony Hilder, we had him on last week, and he'd gotten into a little bit of the opium wars and this sort of thing.
It's gone on forever. That's what Southeast Asia was all about, was to protect the Golden Triangle, the heroin or the poppies that were being grown in the Golden Triangle there.
Right, and then the opium wars of China, and
China, yeah.
And then the spice wars. Was it the Spice Islands and the spice going way back into the when they did the British East India Company? Is that correct? I think that's what Anthony was getting talking about. So, okay, when you're getting out into some really strange areas. That, I mean, it's hard enough to try to convince some people that it, you know, that it wasn't 19 Arabs that was behind.
Yeah, now the only reason, you know, I am very well, you know, I'm an expert because, you know, I flew for 40 years, I built airplanes, I flew them, I maintained them, I did everything. I know that. I know it back and forth. I instructed it. And I know that there's no possible way Arabs could have taken over an airplane, taken over from a crew, and flown it into the building. The first problem you got is, let's suppose he does take over the crew. Well, he doesn't, how's he gonna kill him? Well, they had box knives. Okay. So they had to, you know, the only way to kill a crew member is to slit his throat. So once you get the, carotid artery there, you've got blood spurting all over the cockpit. I mean, there's plenty of it. It's going over the wheel, the instruments. Now you have to get this guy out of the seat so you can fly it, and it's gonna be a mess. I mean, there is gonna be, blood everywhere, particularly if you kill the co-pilot. And then you got him, you know, spurting blood over the place. Okay, now let's say that by some miracle you get the captain out of the seat and back into the passenger compartment, because there's going to be no place in the cockpit for him, and you sit down. Now you've got to take over this Boeing 767, which has an EFIS panel. That's a electronic flight instrument system. It's very complex, and, you know, all these guys, all they did fly is 172s and, you know, stuff like that. They're not going to have any idea, and they're going to have to disconnect the autopilot, head down to New York and fly this thing, and then get to get to the World Trade Center and line up at 560 miles an hour and hit a target that's only 208 feet wide. Couldn't happen. Didn't happen. First of all, airplanes can't go that fast at low altitude. The velocity max operating on a Boeing 767 is 360 knots. When the FAA certificates that airplane, the maximum that it goes is 30 or 40 miles an hour faster than that. That's all it has to go. It can't go any faster for several reasons. One is drag rise in your airfoil drag rise curve rises exponentially after about 390 knots. The other thing is you have a turbofan engine. Your turbofan engine was built to replace the turbojet. The turbojet was the first straight engine that that powered the 707. What they did is they put a prop, essentially what is a prop, which they call a fan, on the front of a jet engine. And the reason, and, you know, it's almost seven feet long there, makes about 14 feet in diameter. And what this thing does is when you're at a very slow speed, it attracts an enormous amount of air and pushes the 767 down the runway for takeoff. And then when it's up 35,000 feet, because the air is one-third as dense, it can take the same amount of air and throw it out the back, you know, to push it along at 530 miles an hour. What it cannot do is take air that's three times as dense at sea level and travel over 400 miles or 400 knots. It can't do it. There's nowhere for the air to go. It would either stall or compressor stall or blow up. It's not designed to do that. It can't do that. So there's only about 100 reasons why there couldn't have been any airplanes crashing into the World Trade Center, but there certainly couldn't have been any Arabs flying. I know too much about flying myself that at the peak of my career, assuming I could get an airplane to go 560 miles an hour, I couldn't have hit a 208-foot target dead center. I mean, it's ridiculous. It can't happen. They, you know, it's a story. It was a magic act. It was an illusion.
So you don't believe it was like a missile or a camouflage?
Too risky. You know, some people said, well, they used remote-controlled airplanes. Why? They didn't have to use anything. Why waste an airplane, and why take a risk of, you know, the airplane? Sure, we can do remote controls, but hit a 208-foot target at you know, dead center? Yeah, that's pretty risky. I don't think they need to do that. And then you come to, you know, where's the parts? There wasn't one single part from any airplane. Now, let me tell you how Boeing 767 is put together. It has 3.1 million serialized parts. Each part has to meet conformity, it has to meet FAA approval, and it has to have a record of where it was made. And there's 3.1 million of those parts. Now, either the part is stamped with a number, which is engraved or stamped or marked on the part someplace. Now, the Boeing 767 also has 90 miles of wiring. 90 miles is a long, long ways to wire, and every single piece of wire is coded where it went, where it goes, what the capacity rating of the wire is, and, you know, it goes all over the airplane. So with those things, you would think that if there was four airplanes that crashed on 9/11, that makes 8.6 million serialized part, and not one single part was ever found that was identified or traced to the maintenance record of any of those airplanes.
But didn't they say they found a black box?
Pardon?
Didn't they say they found a black box?
They allegedly found the black box to Flight 77, and Flight 77 was the American Airlines airplane that allegedly flew into the Pentagon. I think it was an overflight. I think they pretended to fly into it, and they overflew it. But I was the guy that did part of the decoding on the flight recorder. Now, there's two flight recorders, one voice recorder, and then a digital flight recorder. And the digital flight recorder records the engine parameters. There's the 150, or the airplane's parameters. There's a 156 parameters that they sample 8 times a second. For instance, they sample the heading, the airspeed, the aileron controls. I mean, just imagine 150 things like that that they sample. But one of the things that happened is when the NTSB released that data,
mm-hmm.
we started going through it, and there's a technical way that they measure altitude. And when you reduce all of the data, whoever was flying that airplane flew over the Pentagon about 400 feet high. But the people who were responsible for that flight recorder, either the FBI, and probably FBI, not the NTSB, they didn't understand how it worked. So they accidentally let that information go through. Now, what I found in the flight data recorder that was so interesting was that when you descend through 18,000 feet, both the pilot and the co-pilot turn their altimeters from what they call standard barometric to field local barometric. In other words, below 18,000 feet, they want everybody having their altimeters set to the same pressure so that nobody hits each other. Above 18,000 feet, it's standard, 2992. They don't care. There's 2,000 feet separation up there. Nobody cares about that. But under 18,000, you have to set it. So as you're reaching 18,000, you usually center says something like United 465, descend and maintain 15,000, Chicago altimeter 2967. And so then they know that the pilot knows that when he descends through 18,000, he sets his altimeter to 2967. Well, what happened on this flight data recorder for 77 that Hani Honjura was allegedly flying? Here's an Arab pilot, his first time in a 757, and he's allegedly flying by himself. And so the flight data recorder shows the co-pilot's altimeter being reset to Reagan International pressure at exactly 18,000 feet. Then 30 seconds later, it shows the pilot's altimeter being set to Reagan International pressure at that time. So my question is, what in the heck is Hani Honjura setting the co-pilots where, you know, he'd have to undo his seatbelt, get out, go over and set the altimeter, then he'd have to come back and set his. What's he setting the altimeters anyway? He's going to crash. He only set the altimeters, you know, if you're going to be making an ILS approach. So there was no reason to set those altimeters. What it tells me is, you know, professional pilots were flying that thing in a simulated Pentagon crash flight, and they were just going to take that flight data recorder out and substitute it, you know, for the alleged crashed airplane. But what they didn't realize is they were taking their, you know, doing their regular duties up there, and they didn't realize that eventually somebody would come across it like me and figure out, hey, why are those altimeters being set so professionally? Hani Honjura didn't do that.
So that's kind of like a Project Northwoods scenario then.
Yeah, sure.
Uh-huh.
And then the Shanksville airplane was Flight 93, and they tried to say an airplane crashed there, but, you know, I'm telling you, I've been in the business for 40 years. I've looked at in some form, either by reports given to airlines or NTSB reports, every single crash since 1960 and some before that. And there's no airplane that can disappear like at Shanksville. It's ridiculous. It didn't happen. There was no airplane in Shanksville. For the people who say there was an airplane at Pentagon, all I can say is, look, there was a Army intelligence staffer there. Her name was April Gallup. Her desk was 40 feet from the entrance hole. Her six-month-old son was at her feet on the desk, and when the explosion came, she saw the hole in the wall. She picked up her son, put him on her shoulder, and went the 40 feet to that wall, the hole in the wall, and crawled through that hole onto the grass. She said there was no airplane, there was no missile, there was no fuel, there was no gas. All there was that one explosion there. So there was no airplane there.
So you don't even think it was a missile either, huh?
No, there was no missile there. You know, that hole that you saw in the whatever ring it was, but, you know, somebody made that, but no missile went through there.
And not even a small plane?
No.
Okay, so, I mean, you're part of the pilots for, is it pilots for 9/11? Is that?
Yeah, it's pilots for 9/11. They're a group of professional pilots who are, you know, organizing to see if we can't get something done about calling, you know, taking the people who are responsible for this and getting them into court.
Do you think that'll ever happen?
Probably not. They've been doing this for years.
Mm-hmm.
This is just another one of their deals, and they've got, you know, the military-industrial complex has been getting stronger and stronger, and they've got control of everything. There's just, you know, there's just nothing that anybody else can do.
Uh-huh. So when you were talking about something other than it wouldn't have been an airplane of any sort that hit the towers, where do you get any kind of information to think that it could be something else?
I'm sorry, I'm not following you there.
Well, when you're talking, if it wasn't the Arabs in an airplane and it wasn't a remote-controlled airplane, where are you getting the information that about these, like a beam or Star War weapon is what?
Oh, by the direct energy weapons. Well,
yeah,
because of the way that it was destructed. I mean, they just collapsed from the top down in 10 seconds. Controlled demolition can't do that. It's got to be something else. And it just happened that on my website, not mine, I have a website that I contribute to. It's called thelivingmoon.com. We were exploring all the... Excuse me, let me take a glass of water.
Okay.
We were exploring... happened to be exploring all the satellites and weapons platforms that have been placed up in orbit around the Earth since 1968. You know, the Apollo program, the Apollo mission started in 1969, July... And they were all fake. Nothing happened. We didn't go to the moon. Armstrong, Collins, and Buzz Aldrin, they didn't go to the moon in Apollo 11. Nobody went in Apollo 12. Apollo 13 was a hoax. Same thing with 14, 15, 16, and 17. It didn't happen. It was a cover. And the reason for the cover was they wanted the public to think that the moon was airless, that it was a vacuum, that there was nothing there, that it was a mud ball. That there was no air, it was black, it was it looked scary, you know, da 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 da. You know, the truth is, we see one side of the moon, but the other side, there's millions of people there. There's lakes, rivers, forests, cities, snow-capped mountains, the stuff that you couldn't believe is there.
Okay, I want to go there, but while we're on this beam weapon...
So these beam weapons were beginning to be launched by 1968, and now there's 20 or 30 of them in orbit around the Earth. Now, the French asked the U.S. about 2 years ago, they wanted to expose it, and the U.S. threatened them and said, "Don't, we don't want you talking about them." And if you go to thelivingmoon.com, you can see that French request to the United States about those.
So, and we would honor the French on that. Don't we have a facility down in Albuquerque that has something to do with that?
Direct energy weapons?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, there's about 40 companies down there that have direct energy weapons, or that have something to do with direct energy weapons.
Okay, and that's part of the Star Wars.
Well, they call it Star Wars. It's direct energy weapons.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean,
but they've been launched, and and they go around the Earth all the time. Now, here's the funny part, is the space shuttle has been launching since 1981. And I find this hilarious, but other people don't. They, some of them don't even get it. But when the space shuttle launches, it always takes 3 days to catch up with the International Space Station. It's such a joke, and I think, you know, can't you look over your shoulder and you see the ISS coming, and then just before it gets here, launch, because it only takes 9 minutes to get up to 220 miles where it is, and then you could just talk, oh, no, no, the orbits are so complicated, and the inclination has to be 70.6, and we can't change it in the air. It's not true. We can do anything with that shuttle. It's got 43 motors on it. It can change orbit any time it wants. So last year, I got to figuring out what it was doing. When it launches, and I figured this out because it showed a picture of the space shuttle with the hatch open when it got to the ISS, and most of the stuff is gone. So what they're doing is they're launching, and they're hooking up with these different space stations, the other weapons platforms. Now, in order to, you know, those weapons platforms have to be manned, and I usually ask people, how many astronauts do you think are current right now? How many do you think we got? And they say, oh, maybe 50 or 60. I said, let me tell you something. Between the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy, we have an astronaut corps of over 4,700 people. And they're up there, and all of them are current qualified, and all of them are up there. They say, well, how do they get them up there? And they say, well, they have secret ways of getting them up there. One is the Titan II. That little module on top of that, they can put, you know, three or four guys in there. There was just a launch the other day, the one. And they say, yeah, but nobody, you know, we don't see the launches at Canaveral. I said, they don't make them from Canaveral. They launch them from the Ronald Reagan launch complex out on Kwajalein. And they have other places. They can launch them from the Woomera base in Australia. I think there's about 14 different launch pads around the the world that that NASA has access to. That's no problem getting them up there. Space station is just a cover. Now, the space shuttle gets to the International Space Station, and they do their little busy work there for 10 days. And what most people don't know is two Russian rockets have already docked there. And what they're doing is they bring up more stuff. And they put this, you know, fresh fruit and cargo and everything back into the shuttle. And then when the shuttle leaves, you know, the joke is, hey, it only takes 54 minutes to deorbit and land at Kennedy. Why does it take 2 days, always take 2 days? And, you know, the debunkers always say, oh, well, they have to do all these checklists, and they've got to do 2 8-hour rest periods because they've been working so hard on the International Space Station and da-da-da-da-da. Well, that, you know, that's baloney. What they're doing is they're going to take all the stuff that they loaded onto the space shuttle from the Russian cargo ships that came up to the International Space Station and take it to the rest of the orbiting platforms that are waiting for their deliveries. That's what's happening on the shuttle program.
Why is it that we're not seeing these?
Seeing what?
When they're launching all these, some of these things must be pretty good sized.
Well, you can't see a launch from Kwajalein Island. It's out in the Pacific.
Okay, all right. And what about people with their telescopes and things of that sort? That sort of thing wouldn't.
There's plenty of pictures of those orbiting weapons platforms. If you're Googling, just go Google FAST. And there's a guy in England that's got a whole set of pictures of these fantastic weapons platforms. I mean, they're just mind-boggling. And, you know, all he's using is a 10-inch scope, and they're not that clear. But for somebody like me who knows basically what's up there, you know, I don't have any problem visualizing what those fantastic machines that are up there.
And so they don't try to disguise them or anything. They just, you know, they're just going back and forth on
right.
a regular basis.
Yeah, they don't try to disguise them.
Huh.
And it's my understanding that many of the satellites that are up there, even for doing a Google, actually have deliberate dark spots on them, so you don't get to see a full picture of what's there. Have you heard that?
You mean on the International Space Station?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, there's always close-up shots, but you rarely get to see the whole thing. And the reason is there's so many other ships up there. I mean, we've got stuff that you wouldn't believe. And that place is busy. I mean, it's got a, if you go to thelivingmoon.com, we've got information on what the store there is, you know, because people, when they're up on those weapons platforms and the space station, everybody wants to go to the store. They got to buy this, they got to buy that. So, you know, there's a store up there and all that, you know, they have to have a place to put all that stuff. So it's a busy, busy place. It's nothing like what the press tells you is going on up there.
Okay, so how do you know this? I mean,
well, by deductive reasoning, we can get the, we've got the manifest of the Russian ships that go up there, what they're taking up there, and you can just add up all the cargo that's going up there. Fresh fruit is really in demand up there, you know, and that only lasts 3 or 4 days.
So I guess by, you know, you were bringing up the moon, and you might as well go ahead and get into how you this bit about the cities and lakes and rivers, meadows, forests, and snow-capped mountains.
Well, first of all, Richard Hoagland is the one that got me interested in the moon, and he had a video called The Moon-Mars Connection. And in this Moon-Mars Connection, he had a lunar orbiter photo. Now, lunar orbiter was a series of satellites built by Lockheed that allegedly took pictures of the moon in 1966 and 1970. In 1967, there was five of them, lunar orbiter 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and they all took different parts of the moon. But basically, what they were interested in is flying, trying to find a suitable spot for the Apollo missions to land. And so they took thousands of pictures, and they're really great pictures. I mean, you can see all kinds of stuff. Now, the public doesn't get to see any of the pictures that haven't been thoroughly airbrushed. And so one of the pictures, Hoagland had a very good connection somewhere, and he got some of the pictures that weren't airbrushed. And one of these pictures was called Lunar Orbiter 3, negative number 84M. And it's a oblique shot of the Sinus Medii. Now, the Sinus Medii is dead center of the moon. If you look out at night and you see the full moon, right dead center is a place called Sinus Medii, or middle cavity. Right in the middle there is this tower. And it, you know, looks like it's made of glass. It's probably something else. I don't know what it's made of, but it stands about 6 miles high. It has a tripod kind of affair that goes up about 4 miles or 5 miles, and then sitting on top of it is a gigantic cube. And, it, you know, you can see that it's been aged and riddled and probably hit with meteorites and whatever not, but it's standing there right in the Sinus Medii. And when I saw that, I was just enthralled. I'm thinking, what in the heck can that thing be?
And it's been there a long time?
I'm sure it's been there a long time.
Okay, I mean, okay. Let me go ahead and do a break here. And,
okay.
Okay, you're listening to KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, community-supported radio. And the disclaimer tonight is that the views expressed by this program are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And KHEN is supported and TruthQuest brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Properties, Inc., Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just about 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at ColoradoHomeProperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. And tonight with me on TruthQuest is Katie O'Brien, my co-host, and our special guest is John Lear. Okay?
John, when you are saying that this tower has been there for many, many years, are you talking past the 20th century it's been there, or just since the 20th century?
Well, you know, I don't know. I can give you an opinion.
What's your opinion?
I think the moon has only been there about 30 or 40,000 years. It was brought from somewhere else and placed in orbit around Earth. Now, the moon is in rotational lock, and what that means is that as it rotates once on its axis, that's the exact same time that it takes to rotate around the Earth, and that's 27.4 days. So what that does is it only allows us to see one half of the moon. We just see that one half at any time. At no time can we see the other half. And the other half is where all the action is going. Now, it was towed in orbit, and I think that they used a electromagnetic vehicle, and I think that vehicle is in the crater, parked in the crater Chelkowski. Now, Norman Berggren was interesting guy. He worked for 20 or 30 years with Lockheed and the major companies within the aerospace world. And when he retired in 1986, he got a hold of some of the Voyager pictures of Saturn. And he started working with them, and he wrote a book called The Ringmakers of Saturn. And his name is Norman R. Berggren. Now, The Ringmakers of Saturn is a fantastically interesting book. He takes the original Voyager pictures, and in the rings of Saturn, he found these gigantic spaceships. One of them, the biggest one, is 30,000 miles long and 2,400 miles in diameter.
And
you'd have to read the book and look at the pictures, because he has photos of them, and it's just fascinating. But anyway, at the end of his book, he talks about our moon and his theory on how it was towed into orbit and where they grasped onto it with this electromagnetic vehicle, and that was Mare Orientale. And if you, Mare Orientale is on the far side, and you can see these kind of burnt rings around it where a vehicle of some type might have grasped onto it and hauled it someplace. Now, I don't care, I don't know where it came from, and I don't know how long it's been here, but I do know that it's been in rotational lock for a good long time. And the reason I say this is because when you ask me how old the tower is, well, it's probably as old as the moon.
Okay.
Now, the moon could be, you know, billions of years old for all we know. It's essentially a spaceship. People live inside. People live on top. You know, it's a gigantic machine.
Why would you think
it orbits around?
Okay, now, I've heard of reasons for why they think it may be there, but then again, it doesn't make sense to me as being sort of something to keep things from hitting the Earth, but I'm not even sure if that, you know, does that make sense? Things from in space from hitting the Earth, but I'm not sure that, I mean, I'm not, this is all relatively new to me, and in fact, I find it kind of interesting that when you first heard this, didn't you think it was pretty unbelievable? How did they bring you around to believe that, you know, there's something to that?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, it's pretty unbelievable to somebody that's never heard this information before, unless you have some kind of basis to believe it. Why do you...
Me specifically?
Uh-huh.
I'm an information hound, and I listen to everything and everybody, and I'm a voracious reader. I read hundreds of books, and I take all this information and the stuff I get in the books, and then because of, you know, what I did all my life, I have interesting contacts, and I've had, you know, met some real insiders, maybe just one or two, who's given me some keys, some clues to information. But most of this stuff I've figured out by myself, by either reading, and it's not mainstream stuff. You got to go back and let's see, who was that Danish mathematician back in 1856 who made a presentation to the Paris, I can't remember, but he's had some interesting theories about the moon as far back as then. He thought it was populated, and he thought it was the far side. And the guy was really respected, and the scientific community bought into what he was saying. But in 1970, a guy went over there. His name was Simon Newcomb. And he went over there and told everybody, no, this guy is full of beans. It's not true. And you ought to forget what he told you. And so everybody forgot, you know, and disbelieved this guy. It turns out that Simon Newcomb was a rear admiral with the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C. It was in his interest, and it's always been in the Navy's interest, to cover this stuff up. The Navy has always been the top of this thing. It's never been the Air Force. Everybody thinks, you know, the Air Force covers up, you know, and they do to somewhat, but they're a relatively new service. They were only formed in 1947. It's always been the Navy that's been totally in control here. And the Navy has so many secrets here that it's just interesting. One secret I found out last year was just really neat. I live in Las Vegas, and my folks, who are both passed away, used to live in Reno, so I spent a lot of time driving between Las Vegas and Reno. Well, about two-thirds of the way to the Reno, there's a little town called Hawthorne, right in the middle of the desert. And there's a mountain range there, and on one side of the road, there's a U.S. Army ammunition depot, and on the other side of the road is a place called Naval Undersea Warfare Center. Now you'd wonder, what in the world is a Navy Warfare Center doing out in the middle of the desert? Well, I pondered this thing for 30 years, and every once in a while I would run into somebody who said, you know, there's a submarine base down there, and there's a little lake there. It's called Walker Lake. It can't be 15 miles long, and it can't be more than 100 feet deep, so no submarines go there. Well, what I found out last year was incredible. I ran into a guy, and I won't tell you who he was, who told me that the Pacific Ocean underlies most of the western United States, and the Navy has bases under most towns, like Hawthorne, Las Vegas, Pondroy, all those places. And what happens is there's an entrance to this underground. Actually, you know, it's not an underground sea. It's the same level. It's the Pacific Ocean underlies the plate, and they can, just north of Monterey, just north of Fort Ord there, they can enter this sea, and they can go under Hawthorne, Nevada. And what they did is they built an elevator down there that goes down 4,300 feet. And all of this ties in together because there's an ammunition dump, or not an ammunition manufacturing plant across from Hawthorne that makes specific weapons or ammunition and stuff for the Navy to launch, and nobody ever sees a truck going south. Nobody ever sees a truck going north. What it's doing is it's going down. All they do is, you know, load up this ammunition and stuff, and that's not the right word. I'm trying to think. I got the, it's a word you use for missiles and stuff. But anyway, all they do is go and take this little train, go over to where the elevator is, unload it, goes down 4,300 feet to the level of the Pacific Ocean, loads it onto the all the submarines down there, and goes back out the the sea to Monterey, and then out to the Pacific Ocean.
So you're saying that we're an island?
It's not an island.
Uh-huh.
It's just that it's a plate, and that covers and sits on top. In other words, it's not solid all the way. The Pacific Ocean underlies most of the United States.
Because, I mean, the Native Americans, didn't they used to call us Turtle Island?
Pardon?
Didn't the Native Americans used to call the United States Turtle Island?
I'll have to check on that. That would be really interesting.
Yeah, they did.
Uh-huh. And
that would be really interesting if they did.
And as far as, I mean, that's really interesting. So there's a whole lot of things going on beneath us that we don't even know about.
You know, I had a meeting here with three guys, me and a Air Force guy and a friend of mine that helps me run the livingmoon.com. And we sat around one night, and I gave them a question. I said, you know what we know. We know a lot of stuff. If one was we knew nothing, and 100 was we knew everything the government, no, if 0 was we knew nothing, and 100 was everything that the government knew, where do you think we are? And we all three came up with the same figure, which was 0.7.
Whoa.
We don't even know 1% of what's going on. And I could go on all night long on the stuff that I know, the secret stuff I know, that people just, I mean, they couldn't believe it. And that's, you know, it's called, you know, it's ignorance is an insulting word, but I don't mean it that way. And when I say technological ignorance, is because people just aren't technologically informed to know how this stuff works. For instance, I say that, you know, no Apollo mission landed on the moon. There's technical reasons for that, and you have to be very informed on what's going on to know what those reasons are. The main reason is because we didn't have the technology to do that. The moon's gravity is about 64% of Earth. Now, we've been told it's 1/6 the gravity of the Earth, and we believe that to be true because Isaac Newton made up this formula in the 1600s, and the formula was based on the theory that mass density is responsible for gravity. And the fact is, it's not responsible for gravity. What creates gravity in a planet is Kepler's third law, which states that the gravitational force is acceleration times the distance of that planet from the sun. That's what creates gravity. It has nothing to do with mass density. Well, when you understand that, then you understand, well, the moon's gravity is not 1/6, it's more, it's 64% or more. The reason we think it's 64% is because if you use the Newton-Bulley-Aldous law of inverse square, where all you need is the neutral point and the size of the planets, and the neutral point is 43,495 miles. When you use that, you don't need to know the density. You don't need to know this fabricated density of Earth is 5.5 grams per centimeter squared, or the fabricated density of the moon, which is 3.34 grams per centimeter squared. All you need to know is the size and the total distance. And if you work that out, it works out to be 64% of the gravity of Earth. That means that with 64%, it could hold an atmosphere, which it does, and that people live there, which they do.
I was watching one of the films by Richard Hoagland. I thought I heard him say that there wasn't an atmosphere. Did I misunderstand?
Yes, and that's our main disagreement. And his take on that is, and I didn't see the Project Camelot interviews, but he says, you know, he prefers not to tell people something that they just couldn't grasp. But the fact is, about 10 years ago, when I started getting interested in this stuff, I ordered several photos from NASA, and one of them was Lunar Orbiter 2162H, and it's an oblique photo of the crater Copernicus. And it's just a fantastic photo, and if you... it was called the photo of the century even when NASA started showing it. Well, the photo came and I was flabbergasted because, you know, I expected an 8x10 print or something like that, and what came was a 16x20 negative. Now, that was 10 years ago. I mean, even in Las Vegas, as technologically advanced as they are, they had no way to print a 16x20 negative, so I had to wait about 5 years until they technically was sufficiently advanced that I could get a print. When I did, I had it printed out to a 20x24 and took my magnifying glass, and it was just fantastic. It was a mining operation. It was a strip mine, and you could see buildings, you could see vapor rising from vehicles, you could see bucket wheel excavators. I mean, it was just fantastic. You could do everything. And I had it scanned into four sections and put it on a forum on the Internet and asked people to look at the pictures. And one by one, you know, they say, yeah, I see it. holy smokes, I found something else, you know. And, you know, with help on the internet, we found a lot of stuff on there. And those actual photos are on thelivingmoon.com. And if you go there tonight or tomorrow, just, you know, when you open up, you can see these fantastic things we found on the moon. Now, one of the things we were interested in found was, I have a couple of real nice photos taken by the Lick Observatory, which is a 36-inch telescope operated by Lick. And it was a real nice picture of the moon, real clear, and not that clear, but even, about as clear as you can expect from the government. And in the top left-hand corner, there was a white splotch. This white splotch is called Aristarchus. Back as far as the 1600s or whenever they started keeping records, there's always been, you know, lights flashing there and blue glows and, you know, all kinds of, been very interesting. But in any photo you get in the United States of the moon, and there's not very many of them, that will be whited out. And the excuse is, yeah, it's some kind of white crater that we just, you know, we can't figure out what it is. Well, here's the interesting thing. About a year ago, we got a guy with a telescope, 10-inch telescope in England, to take us a picture, and he did some real high-resolution pictures, and I think the moon, he got 92 different frames to make one photo.
Wow.
And so it's resolution beyond anything you have ever seen. And Aristarchus turns out to be what we're pretty sure is a nuclear reactor. It's a beautiful six-sided dome that glows blue. And we had this on display at one of the UFO shows there in San Jose, and one of the physicists, nuclear physicists, came over from Lawrence Livermore Laboratories. He says, you know why it glows blue? And we said, no, why? He said, that's called the Cherenkov effect. He said, that's when radiation hits the air. And it glows blue. So it told us, number one, there is air on the moon, and number two, there is a nuclear reactor up there.
And you, and this is on the side that we see then?
Yeah, that's
okay.
The one
you see. Well, I mean, I've noticed, I mean, to me, when you look at the moon just through some binoculars or whatever, it looks, there's things that reminiscent of looking at the Earth when they show the Google fitted photos of light to me. And it's like almost like you're looking at water, too. But, you know, I don't know about that. But
yeah, there's no water on our side of the moon.
Okay. It just
is
gives
there
it,
water on the other side?
Yeah, water, rivers, lakes. No oceans, but huge lakes and rivers. And
you don't think that's kind of strange why it's only on one side?
No, because I know it's a cover-up. They don't want us to know it's there. When they towed that moon into orbit 40,000 years, the specific task was to be sure that nobody on Earth knew what was on the moon. If you ask John Lear
why?
John Lear doesn't know. John Lear would like to know, but he doesn't know why it's a secret, why we can't know about the other side.
You guys haven't kind of surmised what you think it might be?
No.
I mean, that would drive me crazy. I'd have to be, you know, figuring out why they would be doing that. But it,
yeah, if that drives you crazy, we know about 20 things like that that drive us crazy.
Now, I noticed Ted Tweetmeyer does some of these photos like you do, analyzing. Have you?
Ted has come up with such interesting information. I mean, every time that guy posts something, you know, it's really good, really interesting information. He's the one that came up with the ladder differences on the lunar orbiter, I mean the lunar lander. And of course, you know, the lunar lander, it could have never have happened, and here's why. Because the all-up weight of the lunar lander was 36,000 pounds, and the fuel aboard was 22,000 pounds. Well, when you have 64% of Earth's gravity, that's the reason why NASA was orbiting at 60 miles. If it was only 1/6 gravity, they'd be down at 15 miles. So their excuse to orbit at 60 miles was they said, well, there's these mascons all over the moon, and they play heck with the gravity, and dipsy-doodle here and dipsy-doodle there, so we just had to stay up to 60 miles. No, they had to stay up to 60 miles because there's 64% of Earth's gravity, and that's the lowest they could go. So they get ready to launch the lunar lander, and they get into a ellipsoidal, theoretically, they're going to get an ellipsoidal, elliptical orbit and dip down to 10 miles and let the lunar lander detach from the command service module and then light the engines. And that engine puts out 10,000 pounds of thrust. It's going to go through 22,000 pounds of fuel, you know, a lot faster with 64% gravity than getting down to the moon and having to take off again with the remainder of that 22,000 pounds of fuel. No, didn't happen, couldn't happen, you know, wouldn't happen. It was impossible. Just lately, I've been going through the records of the lunar lander, and it's amazing. This magic trip just kept us believing all this baloney about Apollo all these years, and all you have to do is look at the cold, hard facts, and that lunar lander couldn't have possibly done the stuff that it was supposed to. First of all, do you know in the lunar lander, the pilots had to stand up. There was no couches. There was no seats, no nothing. They just stood up and held onto a bus strap. Can you imagine that?
For how long did they have to do that?
For the 14 hours, it was 12 hours down, or 2 hours down, 12 hours on the moon, and 3 hours back up.
Okay.
So the interesting thing is I have all the books of all the Apollo crew members that have written, and I was just reading one where he was describing his takeoff from the moon, that they had an acceleration of 5,000 feet per second, which is 3,400 miles per hour. Now, can you imagine holding on to a bus strap at 3,400 miles an hour? Give me a break. I thought that was hilarious.
I'd like to meet the man who could.
I thought Richard Hoagland also said something to the effect that, you know, that mission happened.
And he could have. Richard and I don't compare notes. You know, he got me started, and triggered my imagination. But you know, it's not like I call him up all the time and say, "Well, what do you think about this?" Richard Hoagland has his own deal. I have my own deal. We don't compare notes.
Okay. Well, I didn't know how you guys, you know, met up or whatever, but I just, you know.
I have a great deal of respect for Richard, and he's done some amazing things. And like I say, he's the guy that got me started. So.
Well, his information.
You know, we may have different opinions, and I can't tell you who's right. I think I'm right, but you know, and I'll give you the reasons, but. You know, there's no reason why he can't be right.
And well, his book sounds real interesting too. I'd like to
Dark Missions. If anybody wanted to get a foothold on what really is going on in the space program, Dark Missions would be an excellent read. I took it up. I have a cabin in the mountains, and when I have something very important to read like that, I always go up to the cabin with my yellow highlighter and orange highlighter and black felt tip pen. And I just, you know, when I'm up in the mountains, there's nobody for 46 miles, and it's very, very quiet. And I'm not distracted, and I can, you know, read 8 to 14 hours at a time.
Wow.
And really, really get into the thing.
Uh-huh. Now, another person that you're friends with is Bob Lazar. Would you like to get in a little bit on your relationship with him? And
sure. Bob and I met in the summer of 1988. I had given a lecture on UFOs at the Clark County Library, and I was so overwhelmed with phone calls and people knocking on the door and everything. I mean, you can't imagine what it was like. It was just something. It was driving my wife nuts, and she was getting irritated, and And so I kind of shut down for a while, and I didn't take any calls or anything. And one day this guy calls up. He says, hey, I'd like to, you know, get together with you and get some of the books you got and papers. And I said, well, you know, I can't, I'm out of it here, but, you know, if I ever get back into it, I'll give you a call. He says, okay, well, you know, if you ever need a real estate appraisal, I'll trade you the real estate appraisal for the books and tapes. I said, oh, wait a minute. I do need a real estate appraisal. And he said, okay, well, let's do it. So he came over the next day with a friend. And the friend was Bob Lazar, and Bob Lazar was going to hold the tape measure for this guy doing the thing on my home, measuring and stuff. So we got to talking about UFOs and stuff, and Bob sat there rolling his eyes. You know, he didn't believe a word of it. And we said, "What's the problem?" He says, "Look, I worked at Los Alamos National Laboratories." He said, I had a top secret clearance. If anything like this would have been going on, I would have known about it because I stuck my nose into every single place I could. And so he didn't believe any of this, but this is like June of 88. So over the next 3 or 4 months, we gave Bob some information, and he contacted some guys at L.A. at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and we gave him enough information, and enough of it checked out that he decided, you know what, maybe this is true. I'm going to find out for myself. So he went to get a job up at Groom Lake Area 51, and the way that he did that is he called Dr. Edwin Teller, who was the father of the H-Bob and who he knew. And Teller said, do you want to work with me here at Lawrence Livermore or there in Las Vegas? And Bob said, I want to work at Groom Lake. Teller says, okay, well, let me see what I can do. So the first thing Bob knows is now it's November. He gets called down to EG&G, which is Edgerton, Germishausen, and Greer, one of the contractors here on the test site, for an interview. And it turned out he had 3 interviews, one every about 4 or 5 days. And they were very technical. And he said he aced every single one of them. And so then I remember on December 6th, 1988, I was writing out, I was sitting at my desk here, and Bob comes in and sits down across from me. He says, I saw a disc today. And I said, what? He said, I saw a disc today. I said, you went to Area 51? He said, yeah. And I said, you saw a flying saucer? He said, yeah. I said, theirs or ours? He said, theirs. So I said, what are you doing here, Bob? I said, you know they're going to follow you. Why don't you find out what you can and then tell me what's going on? He said, you know, John, you've been taking such a hit on talking about Area 51 and people not believing what's going on there. I had to come up and tell you, you were right. It's all there. So we became good friends, and he worked another, 4 or 5 months up there. And then he took me up, as a matter of fact, the date was March 22nd, 1989, was the first time we went up, and they were test flying the flying saucer, and we were going up and watching the test flights. And the third night we went up, which was April 6th, 1989, we got caught by security, and they phoned in his name, and his boss called him the next day and said, Bob, I'm going to come by the house. Don't go over to the airplane, and we got to talk about some things. So he took Bob up to what was then called Indian Springs and is now called Creech Air Force Base, which is the place where they have all the main security for all of the test site there. And they took him out of the car with a gun in his ear and took him in this room and said, now, Bob, when we told you about the flying saucers, it didn't mean you were supposed to tell all your friends about them. It's a secret. Now, if you want to work up here, you got to help us keep the secret. So Bob was noncommittal, and the reason he was noncommittal about working up there is because when he would get on the 737 there at McCarran Field, before they had the Janet Terminal there on the west side, he would get on at the Escondido operations. And the last 2 flights he made up there, he could remember, he said all he could remember was going up the steps of the plane and coming back down the steps of the plane. In other words, they've got the mind control so effective now that you can work on a project and absolutely not remember it. And he didn't want to work on a project under those circumstances. He would want to remember it. So,
you know what they were using?
Pardon?
You know what they were using for this mind control?
No, I don't know what they were using, but they've been working on mind control since the 40s. And they've got it so advanced now that, say, an engineer at Lockheed can walk right into a room, work for an hour on a project, walk back out and not remember anything he did, and the main thing is it doesn't bother him. The problem they had in the past, say before the past 20 years, was that they'd always have this nagging feeling, I did something and I can't remember what it was, it's driving me nuts. That's not true anymore. Now they don't have any memory at all of what they worked on.
And they don't have any residual effects from...
No residual effects.
Because I think somewhere, I don't know if it was in your Camelot or somewhere when they were saying that the astronauts experience that, they do that also to the astronauts.
Yes, they did go through some very, very serious mind control. And in Buzz Aldrin's book, Back to Earth, that he wrote right after he got back, or no, he wrote about 3 years later, he says that, you know, he can't remember what it was like to be on the moon. That's also echoed by Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Dr. Edgar Mitchell says, you know, I'm always asked two questions when I go out in public. He said, number one is, how do you go to the bathroom in space? And number two, what's it like to stand on the moon? And he says the first one is pretty easy to answer because you tell them about the fecal containment unit and the sponges and the diapers and all that stuff. He said that the second question about what it's like to be on the moon is harder to answer because I can't remember. And Buzz Aldrin says the same thing. In his book, he tells of a story when he gave a lecture, not a lecture, but he was before a group at Lancaster, California, and he was being asked questions by a reporter, and the first question was, Buzz, now that it's been about 2 years since you stood on the moon, tell us, what was it really like? And Buzz says he got sick and dizzy, and he walked out in the alley and threw up. He said it just bothered him. He said, I can't remember. I just can't remember what it was like. So they went through some form of mind control. And
The fun's taken out of it.
Pardon?
All the fun's taken out of it then.
Yeah.
Because you don't
I'm pretty convinced that the Apollo missions didn't go, but I don't know how they did it. It was magic. You know, when NASA was formed, as Richard Hoagland says, there were three main groups, the Nazis, the Masons, and the Magicians. And the reason they needed the Magicians is for all the illusions that they would have to go on. And you know, Apollo was the biggest illusion. You know, pretend that we went to the moon. You know, we want the public to absolutely believe it. And most of the public to this day, Neil Armstrong stood on the moon, and you know, I'm here to tell you, it did not happen. He did not go to the moon. He didn't stand on the moon. Nobody did. Now, we have been there, and we've been there since 1962, but not the Apollo missions. We went another way.
So by the time that they actually were showing us the Apollo missions, it was a done deal.
We had already been to Mars. See, we originally went to the moon in 1962, and we went to Mars in 1966, and we have, you know, huge mining operations on both of these places. And, you know, NASA's interest is for us to think that we were the only ones. We're not. Venus has people that live on us on there. Mars has a population of 600, let's see, what is the population up there? I think it's 600 million.
Where do you come up with these figures?
These contacts that I have.
Oh, okay.
Jupiter, Neptune, all these planets that you're told are gas giants. There's not. There's only two gas giants in the universe. The first gas giant is NASA. And the second gas giant is NASA's illegitimate son, Jim Obert. Those are the only two gas giants in the solar system. All the rest of the planets, just like Earth, they all have, you know, gravity. The sun is not a nuclear reactor. It doesn't put out radiation as such. It's a electromagnetic sphere. And each planet, the atmosphere of each planet regulates the temperature of their planet, regulates the electromagnetism coming from the sun to make the temperature comfortable. All the planets are about 72 degrees, just like we are here on Earth. Mars the same. It's total BS about, you know, Mercury being hot enough to melt lead. Mercury is just like here. It's a nice place to go. The atmosphere controls the temperature, not the distance from the sun. Now, the only difference between Earth and all the other rest of the planets here is all the other rest of the planets don't wake up in the morning and look for Muslims to kill.
Or anybody else.
So we're growing up here spiritually. What we're doing, Earth is a place where where our soul matures. And we're supposed to live our lives without envy, hate, or greed. We're supposed to live our lives with integrity. And we keep going back and forth, reincarnating, so to speak. When we pass away here, we're routed up to a, you know, some place where our total life is brought before us. Every single nasty thing we ever did, whether we remember or not, it's all brought to us. If have been particularly bad, then they take us out behind the woodshed and give us the old one too. But whatever happens, we're recycled back into a newborn baby about 3 days old. They usually wait 3 days to be sure the baby is well and healthy and going to make it. Your soul go back in and starts again maturing, trying to learn how to live your life without envy, hate, or greed, and how to live your life with integrity, as much integrity as possible.
No,
the other thing is that you want to tell every day of your life, you want to take each member of your family and tell them how much you love them. That's all you have to do. You don't have to worry about the starving children in Africa. You don't have to worry about the war in Iraq. You don't have to worry whether we're going to nuke Iran or the typhoon in Bangladesh. All you have to do is worry about yourself and living your life without envy, hate, or greed, living it with integrity, and telling each member of your family every single day how much you love them. It's that simple.
So, and where did you get this information, is this being the case?
What information?
The information you're talking about.
Sleeper.
Okay, why don't you get into talking about Sleeper a little bit?
Sleeper was the guy on one of the forums I used to work on, or we used to post on. And he had a thread going called, Are Extraterrestrials Real? As Real as the Nose on Your Face. And it had gone 110 pages, and I started reading it. And I got to about the 18th page, and I said, this guy has been there. This guy knows what's going on. We all know people that have, you know, taken rides in saucers, and they write the books and everything. And, you know, some of them are true, some of them are not. But this guy, the stuff that he said fit into every single thing I'd read in the past 25 years. So I got to the end of the 110 pages, and he was having a little problem because people were giving him such a bad time. And he was having a problem giving his sense of humor. So he got banned, and I found out where he was and emailed him, and I said, listen, guy, you don't know me, but I can tell you, you are telling the truth. So anyway, we struck up a friendship, and eventually I talked the forum into letting him back on. He started another thread called I'm Coming Clean on Extraterrestrials, and there's so much fascinating information about how it works and what we're here for and what we're doing, and it's just so neat. And anyway, I think that thing went about 200 or 300 pages. And so that's the basic thing on Sleeper, and he's got a blog. And I think if you go to Google and just Google Sleeper, S-L-E-E-P-E-R, you can read his blog and get to these two threads. Now, he's just written a book, and I ordered it, and I should get mine tomorrow. It's a book about traveling with an extraterrestrial. It's really interesting. But for those of you who would like to know what happened and what they found at Roswell, Sleeper wrote a book called In League with a UFO, and you can get it at Amazon.com, and it is just fascinating. It's not that thick, it's not that long, but you could tell that he had some inside information, and it's a story about what the scientists found inside the saucer at Roswell and what they did with it. And, of course, it's written, it's fiction, but you can tell somebody had some really interesting inside information.
Well, before we got started on the program tonight, you were getting a little bit into how sometimes you get people that drop into your life that you have to really kind of question how, you know, their information or how they got there.
Yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, when I was tracking down, and, you know, this is, becomes apparent, people knock on the door, hey, I got some information for you, you know, I'll put that into the mix, but, you know, most of my information is not from contacts, it's from digging out, you know, and figuring it out like by myself. Like, I figured out the moon's atmosphere on myself. Nobody told me that. One of the things that just became apparent here in the last 4 or 5 weeks, when it's become obvious that, you know, Apollo missions never went to the moon, is in 1994, a lady came to my door, and her name was Cynthia Fell, and she was from Cody, Wyoming. And she said, I know your sister. I used to work for NASA, and I just wanted to come and talk with you. And I thought, okay, well, this is interesting. So she came in, and basically she said she was a psychologist, and she worked with the astronauts on all the stuff, the cities and everything that they saw, and couldn't, you know, wouldn't be able to tell with the public. And she said they were having a big problem with that, and she was helping it get over it. So now that I find that we never went, I'm wondering if NASA sent Cynthia to make me believe, yes, the astronauts were there, and yes, they did see all this stuff.
Now, I think it's your site that shows pictures of something inside the structure. I mean, some actual structures on the backside of the moon.
We have some very interesting photos, and I have what I did here is about 10 or 15 years ago, both of my daughters lived in Portland at one time or another. And I forget who I had gone up to visit about 15 years ago, but on a whim, I stopped into Powell's bookstore up there, which is a huge bookstore, and I bought every NASA book I could find. And I don't know why I did it, I just did it. And it turns out they have been so useful, because many of them you can't get anymore, because these books have the original lunar orbiter photos in them. Now, they're airbrushed, but because they were airbrushed in the late 60s, one thing NASA didn't know in the late 60s is that 40 years later, 35 years later, the average citizen, average public, would have a laptop with Photoshop programs that were 100 times more powerful than anything they had back then. And we can use filters and masks and coding and stuff like that kind of to peek behind the airbrushing. So there's a big book I have. I think it's 11 by 17 called Photos from Lunar Orbiter. And they have a series. There's got to be 20 or 30 of Farsight photos. Now, what they did is they were very clever, because they have the top part of it's a horizontal picture about, it's about 4 inches by about 11 inches. And the top third of the picture is white, overexposed. And the bottom half of the picture or bottom third of the picture is underexposed, black. And the middle part is the only part they had to airbrush. And so if you know how to to read through the airbrush, as I have over the years developed this ability to see what they're doing, because they very cleverly attach, you know, gray shading to of shapes to other shapes, and you're able after a while to read through that. So what we found in the past year with these photos that I got at Powell's bookstore is just fantastic things on the far side. It's just, I mean, some of the buildings, you can't even call them buildings, they're weird structures. I mean, they're just absolutely fantastic. Now, one of the interesting photos I got is a photo called, was taken by Apollo 8. The negative number was 2209, and I blew that up one day, enlarged it, and I found an actual space facility, landing facility, and space terminal. And one of the interesting things is when I did the George Norrie show, he had Richard Hoagland come on for a half an hour, and I had just posted that space terminal, and so I made him look at it, and I said, "What does that look like to you?" And he says, "An airline terminal." So that, you know, I got that out of Richard Hoagland, you know, and because I would have thought, well, I don't see anything there. But he did see it. It's pretty clear, and we had it colorized. And that photo was up on thelivingmoon.com, and whenever I do the George Knapp show on C2C, they put that photo up there. But it is clearly a space terminal of some kind. Here's the problem. If we were to make the measurements, if we were trying to figure out how big it was compared with the crater that's just above it, the crater is Lomonosov, which is 70 miles in diameter. If we use those dimensions and try to figure out the dimensions of this space terminal, it comes out to be 10 miles wide. So right now we're wondering, what the heck's going on here? How could a space terminal, the size of this thing and the shape of this thing, be 10 miles wide? So now we're wondering, you know, now that we know that the Apollo missions didn't go, I don't even think Apollo 8 and 10 went. Those were the ones that allegedly, you know, first went to the moon but didn't land, just, you know, did a swing around the moon. So the photo I'm telling you about is Apollo 8, 2209. Now that I know that pretty sure that that mission didn't go, where did that photo come from? So we wonder, are they using the original lunar orbiter photos, trying to make them look like Apollo photos, or what's going on here? And now this space terminal that, you know, really looked like a space terminal, except, you know, it can't be 10 miles wide. It's just, well, it can, but, you know, it doesn't seem reasonable. So we're working on that problem now.
Well, it's...
and we can actually view this out at the website, right?
Yeah, thelivingmoon.com. Just go there and go around and see the nuclear reactor. There's a place called Jack Aronson's files, and he has all the secret data on the Russian satellites, Russian rockets, all of our stuff. I mean, it's a fantastically interesting site, if I do say so myself.
Was it also on your Camelot video that had, you got into something like a Brandy or Branson files or something? Is that you that talked about that? Are you familiar with that?
The Branton files were a guy named, I think his name was Alan Walton, and they are some of the most interesting files you'll ever read. I mean, it just, I had them printed out, and I've got them in a 3-inch binder, and I go through them every once in a while, but they're collections of apparently real stories of weird things that happened to people and weird things that he found out, and it's just a fascinating file, and I can get to it on the internet. Just type in Branton files on Google, but I mean, you'll be reading forever, and fortunately, you know, I've always read all my life, and I constantly read, whether I'm driving the car or flying an airplane or sitting on the can or having breakfast or anything. I've always got a book there, and I've always got a yellow highlighter, you know, and I highlight the important stuff in yellow because I tend to remember it. so I can recall it if I need a little fact, you know, 20 years later. You know, I'm 65, and I, you know, I should be failing mentally pretty quickly here, but I'm for some reason I'm able to recall stuff with absolute total clarity, you know, back 30, you know, 40 years ago.
Well, it's certainly fascinating just, you know, picking your brain on some of these things that you've experienced and read. And I'm sure there's plenty more people when I start exploring some of these videos and people that you you're familiar with. I did notice that you went to, there's only like one of the UFO expos or whatever that they have that you actually go to. Is that correct?
Yeah, I used to go to UFO, the one in San Jose. But they didn't invite me this year, so, you know, I don't do much public speaking.
Uh-huh.
For one thing, I don't fly anymore, even though I retired, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. I hit it pretty hard for 40 years, and I worked very hard. I got to the top of my profession, and then I retired. And I don't miss it. I like being around my house. The reason I don't want to fly anywhere is I don't want to be subjected to the humility of going through the TSA security and having, you know, body cavities searched and submitting to searches for something that the government did themselves. I mean, you know, we did that to ourselves. There are no terrorists out there. And so I resent doing that. And also, I can't take my favorite cigar cutter or my favorite cigar lighter or my flashlight or my Leatherman. So if I'm invited to speak anywhere, it better be someplace I can drive and get to in about 16 hours. Otherwise, I ain't going.
Well, isn't there one that takes place in Las Vegas? Is it a crash one that I've heard? I think I've heard Jim Mars speak of it. Are you familiar with the UFO expo there?
One in Las Vegas?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the crash retrieval, Ryan, let's see, what was his name? Ryan puts it on, and it's the crash retrieval conference. Mm-hmm. I've never been invited to it, but I go and listen to some of the speakers, or you know, talk to some of the speakers.
Mm-hmm. And you were, I guess it's getting about the point to wind down, but there's so many other things I'd love to ask. But is it Mr. Farrell or whatever? Were you speaking of him, or is that somebody Richard Hoagland speaks about I seems like I've heard Frank Whalen do an interview with him on something like the Brotherhood of the Bell, or with the Nazi connection to the space program. Are you familiar with him?
No.
Okay. But you did get into the Nazi connection with our space program, and you'd mentioned that a little bit when we were talking before we came on the air.
It sounds so far out, you know, when you talk about Nazis, and I didn't pay any attention to that stuff until Richard and Michael Barron started writing about it. I said, wait a minute, you know, and then this new book that I'm reading called Dark Moon, Apollo and the Whistleblowers, even goes deeper. They go back, you know, to World War One and trace the history of rocketry from back then, and how involved the Nazis were and how we got them in under Operation Paperclip. And Operation Paperclip was operated by John Foster Dulles, who was President Eisenhower's Secretary of State, his brother Alan Dulles, who was director of the CIA, and their sister Eleanor Douglas Dulles, who was the Berlin desk for the State Department. And between the three of them, that's how they got the Nazis in after World War II into the United States, and they infiltrated the military industrial complex and NASA.
So there's a tie-in then with the Raiders of the Lost Ark and the Nazi connection there.
A tie-in with what?
The Raiders of the Lost Ark and the Lucas thing.
Well.
Or you don't, nothing there?
There was no ark.
Okay.
No, there was no, you know, that the story of Jesus was made by Paul, and Paul himself was actually two different people. There's, you know, the Holy Grail, all that stuff. It never happened.
Okay.
And Paul was actually only between like 3 and 7 when Christ was about. I mean, he was very, very young.
Yeah. The story is, you know, you know, and anybody can believe what they want to, and I'm not trying to cast any dispersions, but that story is not true.
Okay, well, I was just curious because a lot of the sci-fi films I do see, you know, threads of truth in, but that one apparently there isn't any connection there with information that Lucas may have had or Spielberg there.
Well, John, you have just given us so much information. It has just been fascinating. Besides going to your website, what one book would you recommend that most people look into?
You know, somebody just asked me for the top 3 books, and when I got to 20, I said, you know, start with these. So what I would suggest is go to a website called openminds.com. There's two websites I post on. One is American Conspiracy, and the other is Open Minds. But go into Open Minds and look under the questions for John Lear. Mm-hmm. And I have a list of books there, but there's so many fascinating books. You know, I'd say start with Dark Mission by Hoagland and Vera. That will get you started. And then Perry Spalter's book. It's 10 years old, but Perry was born in Iran. She got her degree in biochemistry at University of Wisconsin at Madison and is a mathematical genius, and she wrote a book called Gravitational Force of the Sun, and she's the one that figured out that Newton was wrong, that mass density has nothing to do with gravity, that's actually Kepler's third law. So her book is called Gravitational Force of the Sun, and Amazon.com has that. And then for, you know, anybody that's interested in Roswell, you've got to read Lou Baldwin. That's Sleeper's real name, Lou Baldwin, in League with a UFO. And you read that, and if you're as interested in this stuff as I am, it's just fascinating, the stories and what was in that saucer and how it all worked. It's just very interesting. But if you go to Open Minds and go down to Questions for John Lear, you'll find a list of, you know, my 20 favorite books. And, you know, they're not just on space. One of my favorite books is When Thunder Rolled by Ed Rasmus, who was an F-105 pilot and flew out of Thailand during the Vietnam War. And it's the best book on Vietnam that, you know, that was ever written. And it just made me laugh and feel good because he was so honest about everything, about himself, about the airplane, about the war. It was just a tremendous book. That's called When Thunder Rolled by Ed Rasmus.
Well, John, you know, we really enjoyed this interview, and I hope, you know, that you'll agree to do another interview at some point.
Okay, just call me.
Okay, and thank you very much for coming on the program this evening.
Okay, thank you guys.
Thank you very much, John.
And thank you, Kate.
You have been inspirational.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.